Welcome to Talk Less Water, a podcast that takes a deep dive into the world of water with those making waves. My name is Todd Bodler, and I'm your host for Talk Less Water. I'm also the principal of Collaborative Water Resolution, which you can find at waterdisputes.org. In addition, I'm editor-in-chief of Texas Less Water and the Texas Water Journal. Both publications are free. My guest today is Dr. Helen Dahlken. Helen Dahlken is a professor in integrated hydrologic sciences at the University of California, Davis. She's also leader of the University of California Agriculture and Natural Resources Water Strategic Initiative. Dr. Dahlken has a PhD in environmental engineering from Cornell University. Her current research interests include surface water-groundwater interaction, surface water resources management, vadose zone transport processes, and the applications of DNA nanotechnology and hydrology. One of Dr. Dahlken's main research efforts focuses on the testing and feasibility of using agricultural fields as recharge sites for groundwater banking. Helen, welcome, and thank you for being part of Talk Less Water.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you on. So let's start out with your background in water. When did you first start thinking about a career centered around water?
Yeah, that's probably going back to my undergraduate years. So I obtained my undergraduate degree in Germany at Friedrich Schiller University in Jena. And at that time, we didn't actually have a designated hydrology program. I studied actually geography. And geography contains various aspects of the physical world. So soil science, geomorphology, hydrology was in there, but also social science. And I started working for a professor, a hydrology professor, as a student assistant in my second semester. And I think through that work, I was frequently exposed to hydrological research and just really liked it. And then took more and more classes in that field and, yeah, just really developed a passion for it. And from that point on forward, just really, you know, discovered various aspects of the hydrologic cycle. I've worked in humid temperate climates. I've worked on glaciers and subarctic watersheds. I've worked in the Canadian tundra. I've worked in semi-arid watersheds like California, but also I've been Ethiopia, South Africa, working on various watershed projects. So really interesting field to be in, and we really can't live without water. So it's an important topic.
Agreed there. So you and I have a similar background. My doctorate's in geography, and I can remember when I decided to go to that program. In the United States at that time, you know, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, you know, there was I got different reactions from my professors, my undergraduate and master's programs about, you know, getting a doctorate in geography. But that's very different now. I mean, it seems to me, you know, there's a much, you know, greater, you know, appreciation and understanding among the academic community that, you know, geography programs are, you know, that's where there are a lot of students who, you know, are heading these days. And, you know, there seems to be a shift from some of the other programs in geology, et cetera, into kind of, you know, more the realm of geography.
Yeah, I would say here in the U.S., it has a little bit more a social science emphasis. And students who are more interested in sort of the earth sciences either go into the earth science programs like geology, or they go into environmental sciences. There's only a handful designated hydrology programs, and UC Davis has one of them. So we have a hydrology undergraduate major that really is just about water. So it's much more focused and narrowed down to water instead of, you know, environmental sciences can be many things.
Right. Well, one thing I know about water management, having spent, you know, 25 plus years working for regional agency and others here in Texas, is that, you know, water management's conflict management. And, you know, there's a lot of sociology involved in that. And, you know, I had an had a real appreciation of how geography, you know, integrated a lot of fields that I was very glad that I had that background once I started trying to get out there and work with various stakeholders. So it's been helpful for me, at least. So I wanted to talk to you today in particular about managed aquifer recharge. And so I saw your presentation that you did. You did the webinar for the Arizona Water Resources Institute. I know I got that wrong. Sharon Megdahl's outfit. And I really enjoyed your presentation. And so I thought, well, hey, you know, let's see if you've got a little time to come on this program and talk about managed aquifer recharge. So can you kind of start out with the basics and tell everybody, you know, what it is and what the goal of managed aquifer recharge is?
Yeah, so managed aquifer recharge is a technical term, you know, that we often use in the field of water resources management, and it can have many synonyms. So you might have heard of groundwater banking before, and so groundwater recharge is also another very general term. And so what we typically mean by that is that we would like to intentionally place or retain more water in groundwater aquifers than what would naturally occur through, you know, let's say the natural recharge process that comes from rainfall or, you know, natural flooding, et cetera, in the watershed. So it's really recognizing that our groundwater aquifers in many areas across the nation are in a declining state, meaning that, let's say, storage and water levels are dropping. And that typically is an indicator that the natural recharge from precipitation snowmelt is not enough to make up for the amount that is being removed from the aquifers. And so it's now basically a technology, a practice to intentionally put more water back into those aquifers. And we can have different methods of how to accomplish that. There can be direct methods such as using, for example, injection wells. I think those are fairly commonly used in Texas. Surface spreading methods like infiltration basins. You can do bank filtration, where you basically put wells somewhat close to river. You start pumping from the well and it draws the water through the sediments that are making up the banks of a river. In that process, water that is flowing in the river channel is being cleaned and then can be utilized for some other purposes, like, you know, irrigation, for example. And so it's really about recognizing, you know, our aquifers are in bad shape. We need to do something about them. And, you know, people have come up with various methods on addressing this. And I have to say, this is not a new method. This has been practiced for over 150 years, if not longer.
So in Texas, everybody, you know, the water community is very familiar with, you know, the aquifer storage and recovery facility that San Antonio Water System has, where wells in the Edwards Aquifer draw out water, and then wells put that water down into the Carrizo Wilcox Aquifer, which is nearby. And there's, of course, the big program out in El Paso. I'm not sure as many people are familiar with that. That one does use spreading basins. Mm-hmm. What really caught my attention in your presentation was the integration between agricultural practices and, you know, managed aquifer recharge. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about that, because, you know, we have, you know, maybe some similar opportunities here in Texas. One which you may or may not be familiar with is Texas has created a comprehensive flood management and planning program. Mm-hmm. Similar to our regional water planning process, we now have a flood management and planning process that is going to occur every 5 years. And our first statewide flood management plan is being assembled right now. And So one of the things I'm thinking about is, gosh, you know, it seems like, you know, there's a real opportunity in a process like that to encourage more managed aquifer recharge through agriculture as a way to provide, additional water supplies and firm up what we have now, but also to help reduce flooding, flood attenuation. And so, very interested in your, thoughts on how you see managed aquifer recharge in agriculture, where you are there in California, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, the need comes from, multiple aspects. So agriculture, particularly irrigation agriculture, and we often find those production systems in the arid or semi-arid region. So the southwest of the United States, New Mexico, Texas are included in that as well, where you just don't really have year-round precipitation. So over the years, agricultural producers have started utilizing either surface water from reservoirs or, from pumped groundwater to irrigate their crops at the time when it's needed. So irrigation agriculture in California uses about 80% of the developed water. I don't know what the numbers are in Texas, but most regions that have irrigated agriculture have typically, those are the ones where the agricultural producers are the highest water users. Lower Mississippi and Bayman Aquifer, similar numbers, 80 to 90% of the water that is used for irrigation. We, 40% of the groundwater reserves worldwide are used for irrigation agriculture, so just for food production. So we know we need water in order to sustain these agricultural systems. And for many decades, we have relied on surface water for the most part. It depends a little bit on whether or not you're more in a desert region. But California has a very, intricate system of surface reservoirs in the Sierra Nevada mountains. We have thousands of miles of canals, aqueducts that are then moving the surface water around to fields where you can then irrigate. But with climate warming, we are seeing more challenges. So evaporative demand, that's maybe a little bit a mouthful of a technical term. A warmer air can hold more water. About every 1 degree Celsius that your atmosphere is warming, the air can hold 7% more water. So if your air is getting warmer, that atmosphere is getting thirstier, and it's going to draw more water out of everything, plants, soils, from open surface water bodies. And that has, in California, to some degree, diminished the surface water supply we have available for irrigation. And it has led to increased groundwater use. We've also seen, unfortunately, as a result of climate changes, that precipitation patterns are shifting. We see more drought years, like more years where we just don't get enough precipitation. And that means reservoirs at some point will be empty. You just can't draw more water from them. So where do you look for water? You look in the groundwater. But then once in a while, we get a really wet year, like we just had in California, and we get almost 200% of our normal precipitation. And then, things are flooding everywhere and we just don't quite know what to do with the water. So actually the flood years are more costly for us in California than the drought years, because they just destroy infrastructure. They take, lives that get in the way. And so, but it's really volumes, huge amounts of water that we would love to capture because we know the next drought is going to be around the corner. And this is where managed aquifer recharge is coming in. California has about 42, 43 million acre feet of surface reservoir storage. We rely on our snowpack in the Sierra Nevada mountains. If the rain is not falling as snow, and it's not stored up on the tops of the mountains, we would have to store that water in reservoirs. We just don't have the room for it. But we have a very large aquifer, the Central Valley Alluvial Aquifer, of which we have probably pumped a good 160 million acre feet out of over the last 100 years. So there's plenty of room to actually store water. It's, you know, 3-4 times the amount of surface reservoir storage we have in the state. But the question is, how do you get the water into the ground? It's coming from a fire hose, and you can only put it into the ground through, you know, a drinking straw. And so agricultural land in many ways basically serves as a temporary retention area. So if you have lots of land, large areas of land that you could potentially flood and put the water temporarily on, you can basically alleviate that big flood peak that's coming down the mountain. You can temporarily store that water in the landscape, and then it will sink, it will, you know, trickle into the ground in, you know, days and weeks. So that is what we're trying to do with this agriculture managed aquifer recharge, as we call it, or on-farm recharge. And, you know, some growers might say like, oh, this sounds crazy. I would never intentionally flood my farm fields. But here in California, you know, before we settled this region, these rivers, none of them had levees, right? And when we had winter rainstorms, spring snowmelt, large areas would be flooded naturally beyond the banks of those rivers. And we also used to have a lot more wetlands that would be that would store, you know, water for weeks and weeks and weeks. And we don't have that anymore because we have channelized our rivers. We've put levees around them to protect the lands behind them. And with that, you've definitely lost that natural flood area that also provided a lot of recharge to the underlying aquifer.
So just to back and fill a little bit about Texas related to some of the numbers that you were quoting for California, agricultural water use is about 60% of Texas water use. And we've got about 32 million or so acre feet of surface water storage available. You know, just kind of thinking about the wetlands question there. So California has lost over 90% of its wetlands. And, you know, the Central Valley is kind of one giant wetland. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, we're recreating some aspects of the landscape that were there previously. And so, you know, one of the things I'm very interested in about that is, you know, you're talking about, you know, the agricultural community and, you know, their reaction to this. You know, the areas that you select, you know, I'm sure there's a process where you go in and, you know, you say, hey, this is an area where we know that, you know, if we were to flood it, that, you know, it's likely that you'd have, you know, significant, you know, recharge as a result. And are they also, though, agricultural areas where they would normally have a winter crop or they areas where they're generally not doing too much with that land? It's fallow in the winter. And so it's maybe more accessible for something like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we definitely have some recommendations and criteria for identifying locations that would be most suitable to do this on, because we do recognize that there is risk to the grower. So particularly, let's say if I were to flood a clay-rich soil that's heavy, that's really not well draining, the water would just be sitting on that soil for weeks and weeks. Some would, of course, infiltrate and move to the groundwater, but not much. And we kind of have that situation happening right now in the former Tulare Lake Basin bottom, or Tulare Lake bottom, which is a very clay-rich area. The snowmelt is accumulating in those low topographic areas right now because we don't know where else to put it. And it's just evaporating. There's not much infiltration happening. So we prefer definitely sites that have well-draining soil, so coarser soil textures, sandy textures. And ideally, we would like to have those locations with those suitable soils also overlying, you know, sediment deposits that can contain high amounts of gravel or sand so that the water can really quickly be conveyed into the deeper subsurface. And some of these locations are, you know, more and more being discovered because we are flying airborne electromagnetic geophysical systems and sensors that are basically detecting where these coarser textured sediments exist in the Central Valley. And we've also learned, for example, that wherever these major tributaries, those major rivers are coming into the Central Valley from the Sierra Nevada mountains, in, you know, the past hundreds of thousands of years, these rivers have, for example, eroded very deep channels and then backfilled these channels with coarse gravels and sands. And those are really ideal locations because these incised valley fills, as we call them, are really cutting down deep several hundred feet into the sediment deposits of the Central Valley. And with that, you can really recharge much deeper, you know, aquifer strata than just doing the surface spreading, where you then rely on the water trickling down. Other criteria, of course, that you need are you need to get the water to the sites. So we heavily rely on, of course, surface water conveyance infrastructure. It's more or less impossible to get, you know, recharge going on a field that's not connected to a conveyance system that can direct flood water or any water really to that site. And we're learning that conveyance capacity is a big constraint in utilizing these flood flows because, of course, the conveyance system was not designed to handle flood flows. It was designed to deliver irrigation water. So much, you know, smaller amounts. But I think we're recognizing the need for that. And, you know, there's potentially some funding to expand that. Other consideration, as you mentioned, is the cropping system itself. So California is known for all kinds of different crops. We're growing somewhere between 250 to 400 different crops. Many of them are can't be grown in other regions, like almonds, pistachios, walnuts, citrus trees. We have lots of citrus trees. Those are called perennial crops, so they more or less grow for multiple years. They could also grow in the winter. And so if you then start flooding those crops and the waterlogged conditions that you might create in the root zone, definitely increase the risk of, for example, root damage, that you might pick up some sort of pest, a fungal disease or something that can then potentially, you know, impair the growth of that crop during the growing season and the yield that you might get from that. So there are definitely risk factors to consider. Fallow fields would be ideal, but even here we have sometimes restrictions because tomato growers, for example, like to prepare the beds in the fall. And they don't like to have someone mess with their with their fields in the winter. So they would have to do it again in the spring. But I think, you know, by explaining the need for recharge and explaining what are, you know, really the most suitable locations, I've definitely seen a shift in our grower response from absolute no-no to slowly, you know, I think this is needed if we want to make sure we have, you know, water for future generations.
So if let me make sure I'm following kind of the process. So you're looking for areas that A are, you know, over the right kind of aquifer or the right kind of, you know, gravels and things, and then the right kind of soil, non-clay soil above it, and somewhere, you know, close to where the floodwater is going to be coming from. But, you know, I guess that's one of the areas that I've got a question about. I'll come to that in a second. And then maybe an area that an ag area that's maybe not focused on perennials, but maybe annuals. And when you're talking about using the current canal systems to distribute these flows, I get, you know, one of the things I was wondering originally, and I guess maybe this is not the case, I was thinking, well, you know, maybe they're focusing on areas that are just outside of the levees, and figuring out a way to, you know, allow some of those flood flows to, you know, be diverted without, you know, damaging the levees, so that it's almost like a little spillway, you know, and they're going into some of these pre-selected areas for recharge. It sounds like you're actually trying to use the existing distribution system, which would it seems more complicated because of all the issues related to, you know, people getting deliveries and you know who are not part of this system am I messing that up, or am I kind of
You definitely capture some of those difficulties and discussions we're having. So I should maybe clarify, most of the recharge that we are planning or that we are currently doing in California is done in the winter because our rainy season is in the winter here in the West, somewhere between November and April, May of the following year. So water deliveries, water use is much, much lower in the winter. So you wouldn't necessarily expect, you know, irrigation deliveries in January, for example, because you know, either you already have rainfall, so you don't need necessary water delivery, or you're just not growing a crop right now, or your perennial crop is in dormancy, like, you know, almonds, walnuts, etc. They are all, dropping their leaves sometime in November, and then they might leave out maybe February, March again. So that is why we think it's an ideal period to do this. It does definitely lower the risk of crop damage, focusing that activity onto the dormancy period. I can definitely see many, many more challenges if were to be done during the growing season. We have started exploring those time windows as well. But again, you know, the risk is much higher, and growers are definitely much more risk adverse during the growing season to do this than doing that in the off season. As for conveyance, we don't see much recharge right next to the river. We have a couple cases, but our rivers are basically an ultimate source of groundwater recharge in the Central Valley. So the water table often is the highest around the rivers, and it's lower further away. So you often have these big cones of depression drawn from, you know, big ag wells further away from those rivers where you really don't have much natural recharge. And this is where we are trying to direct the intentional recharge activity. So, and the conveyance system basically can help with that. Yeah.
So say I'm a farmer and I'm participating in this program, and is the benefit to me through, you know, receiving a payment, or is the water which recharges the aquifer essentially, you know, benefiting me for my use at some point in the future? What's the, you know, how is that managed?
Yeah, so right now, intentional recharge requires, particularly if you're using surface water as a source water source, it requires that you have a surface water right to divert that surface water for the recharge purpose. And I should clarify, we can't yet recharge in California just for the sake of recharging. The end use of the water that you're recharging needs to be clearly specified when you're applying for that surface water right. So this is typically done under the so-called beneficial use criteria. So any water that is being diverted from a surface water source needs to be put to some recognized beneficial use, such as irrigation. And so while, you know, let's say if we're in absolute flood mode, so let's say like last winter, an atmospheric river is coming through, we're seeing the stage in the river going up to a flood level and potentially exceeding the banks, flooding adjacent areas. That recharge does not need a permit, and it is also not being credited to whoever is doing it. This is recognized as, you know, a natural process, and actually the law assumes that when water is flooding over the banks of a river, 100% of that water will return to the river. Even though from a hydrologic cycle perspective, we know, you know, might take, it might happen, but it might take years. So right. anyone who is doing recharge intentionally needs a surface water right. It has to be an appropriative water right, where you clearly define the point of diversion, where you define how much water you're planning on diverting, where you're going to put it, where you're going to take it out of the river. In California, the State Water Resources Control Board, the water rights section, they have developed in 2015 a so-called streamlined permitting process, which made all of this a bit easier. So instead of applying for a very long-term surface water right, which can take up to 10 years to review, they basically offered up these 180-day permits, which have a much quicker turnaround time. So typically don't require full review because they've put some checks and balances in there. For example, water can only be diverted if the flow in a river at your diversion point is above the 90th percentile of the historic record. So we're only trying to get flows from the 10% largest flows ever observed or observed over the last 30 years on nearby stream gauge. So that takes care of a lot of the other questions that would typically be investigated in a full water rights application, such as, is there any injury to downstream water rights holders? Is there any injury to downstream ecosystems that are entitled to these flows? So those are, you know, some criteria that that are basically in place.
So that clears something up for me, because when I was listening to your presentation on the webinar, I was thinking, well, it sounds like maybe there's this new permitting process that allows you to capture flood flows, but it's been in place since 2015, and it is targeting that 90 percentile plus, I guess, flow. And we have environmental flow standards in Texas, and we do also have some major permits that have targeted those flood flows, but they're usually almost always down at the coast. They're kind of a coastal diversion where it's anticipated that there's going to be, you know, the ability to divert those flows. There's not really an ability someplace to storm yet, but you know, that's kind of in the thinking. And so you see a number of river basins where, for example, the river authority will have a permit that is just kind of a placeholder in some ways for, you know, in the future, we might be trying to harvest these flood flows and do something with them, but we're not exactly sure, you know, how we're going to do that and whether there's going to be someone who's willing to pay for that. Okay. So that clears something up for me that I was really, you know, curious about. Because those permits that you're talking about, after 2015, you're talking about anywhere in that river basin, right? You're not necessarily at the, you know, near where it discharges into the ocean.
Yeah. So it can be at any location within the state. There's a few exceptions. We have, for example, a couple adjudicated groundwater basins where special rules are in place. But for the most part, you know, any surface water system, if you try to take some water out and use it for recharge, then you will have to go through that route.
Do you ever see any situations where you know, managed aquifer recharge project is not relying on flood flows, but just, you know, existing surface water rights?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so and that's definitely something that has already happened for many decades in many of the surface water districts. So many of our surface water districts, and we have, I don't know, probably over 400 or so in the state, they particularly, some of them have very old surface water rights, so predating 1914. 1914 was the year when the state basically implemented a system that you needed to have a permit and a license in order to divert surface water. Before that, people were just claiming surface water by, for example, pinning a note on a tree, similarly right. to how we made gold claims, right? Those districts that have these pre-1914 rights, since they never really applied for a permit, it's a little bit fuzzy on the amount of water that they can actually divert. And so there is a little bit of check and balance on them, because basically the expectation is that you're more or less using the same amount every year, but you should not be hugely exceeding this amount. So in those wet years, they are basically kind of going to the maximum value of whatever they've used in the past. And often they are then using, you know, surface water. They have their designated recharge facilities, often, you know, infiltration basins within their district boundaries, where they put water, you know, into the ground. They also have asked growers in the past, so particularly, you know, when surface reservoirs need to be emptied because there's more snowmelt coming in the spring, they have, for example, asked growers, can you take additional water right now? Can you do one more irrigation event? Because we do need to put the water somewhere. We don't want to give it away. If you don't use your surface water, you can also lose your water right.
Is there active cancellation in California? I mean, we have that on the books here, but it doesn't ever happen.
I'm not aware of any, but it's also not my area of expertise or research. So you may have to ask the water board.
Gotcha. So groundwater banks, are these projects, you know, typically associated with a groundwater bank? And you know, I'm just curious, you know, how many groundwater banks do you have out there?
We have a couple designated groundwater banks within the state. So, for example, the Kern Groundwater Bank, which is in the Southern Central Valley. There's Arvin Edison. And I think more are being in the process of being formed. And having the designation of groundwater bank often means there is a certain administrative management unit to operating that whole operation. So it's not just like one single private landowner trying to put a little bit of water into the ground. It often, as you know, as described previously, you often have to obtain a surface water right in order to get your hands on the water that you will be putting into the groundwater bank. And for legal purposes, then it's also recommended to, you know, have some sort of stakeholder board or supervisory board that will manage and operate that operation. So, you know, the Kern Groundwater Bank, for example, was one of the first ones, as far as I know, that was formed in California in the 1980s. And they started really clever by making sure they are getting their hands on the surface water that they need for the groundwater bank. And then, of course, there's also, you know, costs associated with maintenance, with buying the water that you put in the bank. So, you know, there's always a financial, management component to it as well. So that's why, you know, having a bank is in many ways beneficial.
So are these banks are there are water markets where you get trades among the folks who are depositing that water and somebody who's got you're going to have to have a well, right? If you're going to take advantage of it.
Yeah. So the current groundwater bank, I don't remember how many acres of recharge basins they have. I think it might be somewhere around 5,000 or so. And they get water from the federal branch. So the Fine Current Canal, for example, and the California Aqueduct, which is our state water project. And then, yes, they do have extraction wells where they can take the water out and deliver it to, you know, customers that have bought into the bank.
Okay. So surface water customers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. What do you think the potential is for more managed aquifer recharge across the U.S.? I mean, is it best suited for the Western states, or do you see other places? And, you know, one of the places I'm thinking about is, you know, the Carrizo-Wilcox Aquifer in Louisiana and Arkansas has seen lots of, you know, I mean, it's a really, you know, big decline there. And so I'm kind of curious how you see this type of project spreading or not spreading across the country.
Yeah, I think there's definitely growing demand for it because groundwater is a freshwater source that we kind of take for granted. But as this like very recent New York Times article highlighted so nicely, we are really quickly depleting that source of water, and to the extent that, you know, it might not be easy to replenish it, and we need it as a flexibility option because the surface water world is just becoming so unpredictable. And even in, let's say, traditional humid temperate climate regions like the Dakotas or, you know, the northern states in the U.S., which typically have had, you know, rain-fed agricultural system, they see more ups and downs too. They are complaining about drought periods. They are complaining about more flooding. So in many of those agricultural regions, groundwater is becoming increasingly a source to even out the water supply. And it has many other benefits. Like using groundwater makes it much easier, for example, to use a drip irrigation system because that is a pressurized system where you can't just like have, I don't know, water flow into one end of the straw and then it will drip out at the other end. No, the water needs to be pushed into that system at a certain pressure, 30 PSI or something, which often means using surface water, it becomes a bit more difficult because it can contain sediment, it can contain other pollutants that are clogging up the drip emitters. So you might have a surface water pump that needs to be installed in order to facilitate all of this. It might not work with the surface water delivery schedule your system, your district might maintain with you. So a lot of, you know, there's a lot of convenience factors to using groundwater. So, but given the state we're in, I mean, the Ogallala High Plains aquifers are very depleted. They're basically pumping fossil groundwater that has been recharged thousands of years ago.
Right.
The Mississippi embayment aquifers, so the lower four states that are on the Mississippi River, see huge declines. I think Arkansas, Mississippi region are now taking number two spot in terms of, you know, overdraft rates. And those trends are very alarming. And if we don't react soon, because I mean, we do have the surface water to replenish. We're just not giving nature and the land the chance to absorb that water because levees, you know, flood risk mitigation infrastructure that we've installed decades ago is designed to take the water quickly off the land and not leave it there. So, and that's where we have to basically find a new middle way.
Right, right. The trend for the last, I don't know what, you know, 400 years in the United States has been, you know, speed up the water cycle. And now we're, you know, trying to find ways to slow it down.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So let me kind of wrap up with this question. You know, I'm interested in, you know, how people can find out more about what you're doing and also find out more about Managed Aquifer Recharge. And so are there some places that you could direct our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So we have the National Groundwater Association in the United States, for example. They have a webpage, NGWA, where you can find lots of informative materials about recharge too. There is the National Academies of Sciences hosted a really nice 2-day webinar workshop on the future of managed aquifer recharge in the United States. Sharon Magdahl from the University of Arizona was one of the speakers. I was a speaker too. It provides a really, really nice overview on the state of the groundwater aquifers, the various recharge methods, information we have on climate, climate variability, source water, water quality concerns, etc. So that might be a nice resource. Here in California, we have the FLEDMAR network. So this is a network that was formed by our California Department of Water Resources with NGOs, with members from academia and consulting firms to really bring in, you know, people that are you know, have a common interest on in recharge and are working in that space. We have a webpage that's called flatmar.org. You can look that up. And then if you have any questions, particularly on this agriculture managed aquifer recharge, I would refer you to me. We have a lab webpage, so that would be dalkey.ucdavis.edu, or, you know, potentially my email, which is hdalkey@ucdavis.edu.
That's great. That's why I had you on, because I knew you're the person to answer all those questions. So I hope you do get some questions from the listeners, and I appreciate you answering all my questions today.
Well, thanks so much, Todd. It was a pleasure.
Well, I enjoyed it as well. So this has been Talkless Water. My guest today was Dr. Helen Dalkey, who is a professor in integrated hydrologic sciences at the University of California, Davis, and leader of the University of California Agriculture and Natural Resources Water Strategic Initiative. I want to thank you, the listener, for spending your valuable time on this podcast. And finally, I want to give a big thank you to Anna Huff at the Meadows Center for Water and the Environment at Texas State University for getting each one of our episodes of Talkless Water ready for the public. And that's pretty much it. My name's Todd Botler. Let's talk water again soon.